I met Eric.
Dave turned up the volume. It was one of his favorite CDs, American Fool, with John Cougar Mellencamp singing his heartfelt ballad about Jack and Diane. He'd hoped that the kids would quiet down and appreciate the music. As usual, they just talked louder to compensate. The coastal drive was refreshing. Once they dropped the children off at Nancy's, he would really crank up the tunes. It was frustrating. Couldn't they see that this was real music? Classic rock. Feel it in your soul. Sing about life. Make a difference music. "Hey guys, listen up," Dave tried again. "Give John a break, will ya?" "Who is John?" Angel asked from the back seat. It was just enough to get Dave started. "Baby, we've had this talk before," he preached. "John Mellencamp, singer of true music, ageless music." Megan sat in the passenger seat, deep into her novel and oblivious to life around her. In his usual sarcastic form, Brad piped in, "Please, Dad, tell us all about it one more time." Brittany rolled her eyes. "I will," Dave replied, as he began to extol the virtues of classic rock over modern bands. "Listen to the emotion in his words." The boulder slammed onto the road so suddenly that Dave just caught a glimpse before it smashed into the front passenger side tire. The van jolted to the left as the tire blew and the axle buckled. Brittany screamed as they slid sideways, the van vibrating violently as metal scraped the road. Dave jerked at the steering wheel, straining in vain to regain control. It wouldn't budge. The air surrounding Dave felt instantly warm, hard, and impenetrable as life tore into broken pieces. Sound distorted. Time slowed. Megan's book dropped to the floor as the van rolled onto its side and then slid over the embankment. Her hand caught Dave's shoulder, grasping desperately for support, before slipping loose. The windshield shattered, bursting into thousands of tiny pieces, filling the van like particles in a kaleidoscope as it turned and bent and twisted. Dave tried to look over his shoulder. Where were the kids? Brad should have been buckled in, but was thrown against the ceiling, or was it the floor? And where were Brittany and Angel? A warm and dark liquid began to fill in the edges of the scene, blurring his vision. Where, he wondered again, was Angel? Then everything went black.
I'm fascinated by circumstance. The way insignificant events catapult our lives into strange directions. It's happened to me. I had a handful of classes left to graduate, one on European culture and the rest electives. The required class was offered at two separate times, and, being a bit meticulous, I already worked up my schedule based on the Tuesday and Thursday course. When I couldn't add the class online, the registrar's office suggested that I be at the school early the next morning. That's when the water pipe broke. It was a main line, a huge cavernous thing that runs below the busy streets, hidden from our view, silently carrying water through the city. And like so many things in our lives, no one thinks twice about it until it ruptures. On the morning I needed to register, I awoke to a street flood in front of the house, with heavy equipment digging up the asphalt and blocking my car from leaving the garage. Though the city's mass transit is excellent, and I'm not complaining, I hadn't planned on the extra time it would take to reach the school. When I arrived, registration was well underway, and the class I needed, the class I'd planned my life around, was completely full. I begged. I pleaded. I whined. They smiled and put me at the bottom of a waiting list 30 students long. In addition to ending up in the Monday and Friday class, I also lost my part-time job. My boss at the time had already arranged schedules, and when my circumstances changed, he couldn't accommodate. I was heartbroken, Until I walked into European culture and met Eric Aldridge. He was friendly and cute, and we hit it off immediately. Being a bit shy, I was flattered that he'd taken an interest in me. We started to date, and by Thanksgiving, the relationship had turned serious. He was starting a job in L.A., and our plans were to marry after my graduation in April. We found a cute apartment in Long Beach, and though it wasn't the ideal situation for an engaged couple, I would come down on weekends after class to spend time with him. As the end of the semester neared, with wedding plans underway, I was giddy. Soon I'd be married to Eric, a man I loved, a man who lifted me up, a man who helped me forget my doubts and insecurities. With graduation approaching, I'd planned to skip my weekend visit with Eric to finish my final project at the university. Then an odd thing happened. Another water pipe ruptured near the history building, closing that portion of the campus for the weekend. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision, but I packed a few things in the car and headed to L.A. As I reflect back now, I'm amazed at how the simple bursting of a water pipe changed my life forever. If not for the flood outside my apartment the day I went to register for class, I wouldn't have met Eric. And not just the first water pipe, but the second one as well. For had it not ruptured near the history building, the university would have remained open. I would have stayed to work on my project, and I wouldn't have surprised Eric in our apartment, sleeping with another woman. Amid my tears and heartache, my father encouraged me not to give up on love, to still keep hope alive in my heart. Since he's been gone, however, it's been difficult to believe. Yet during times of stillness, when I sit alone and ponder my life's direction, I try to remember my father's wisdom. I try to believe that if it wasn't Eric, then there still must be someone out there for me. And so I keep looking. Mostly, though, I find myself watching out for broken water pipes.
Chapter 7. Dave's head throbbed. Was everyone okay? He could still hear the sounds, smell the horror of the accident surrounding him. Yet, when he opened his eyes, it was gone. The sun streamed through the room's only window. The sheets were tucked in tight, clean and sterile. The smell was clinical. He tried to sit up, but a pain shot down his left arm. A downward glance revealed a glossy, translucent tube extruding from a snippet of white tape and gauze attached to his forearm.
Megan, Brad, Brittany.
His voice was hoarse and raspy. No one answered. He reached over with his right arm and pressed the red button on the side rail. Nothing. He pushed it again, and then again. The door swung open, and a uniformed nurse scurried into the room. With darting eyes, she surveyed his condition.
"You're awake."
Her eyes carried a look of surprise.
"Where am I?"
"Connecticut Valley Hospital in Middletown." She moved over to the bed, held his wrist for a moment, then scribbled on the bedside chart.
"Please don't move. Stay still and let me call the doctor."
Before he could mouth his next question, she whisked herself out of the room. No sooner had the door closed than it swung back open, and in stepped a familiar figure. Dave glanced up.
"Brock?"
His friend's eyes looked tired, his right cheek red with crisscrossed fabric impressions, suggesting he had been sleeping against an upholstered chair. Brock approached the bed with hesitation.
How's it going? I mean, wrong question. Today. What's today?
Dave's thoughts were clouded. It was difficult to string words together.
You missed your birthday by a day. The doctors weren't sure at first if you were going to make it.
Both Dave's hands quivered.
Megan, how is she?
Brock rocked back as he rolled in his lips. It was as if he'd been rehearsing his practiced answer for hours. But now that the question had been posed, the words had fled. All that came out was a whisper.
I'm so sorry, Dave. So very sorry.
Panic pounded at Dave's chest as he shook his head back and forth, refusing to believe the news. His movement caused the alarm to sound at the central monitoring station out in the hall.
The kids! Where are my kids?
Brock cast his glance downward as he continued to shake his head. Emptiness poured in through the window and door, filling the room and holding Dave hard against the bed. He needed to get up and find his wife and children, but he couldn't move his arms or legs. He couldn't breathe. His chest ached and heaved, and a pain shot into his left shoulder, but he didn't care. He now wished for death to snuff out his life as well. While he continued to writhe and cry, a doctor entered the room, and with the help of a nurse, pushed a syringe of sedative into the IV tube that was taped to Dave's arm. Within seconds, the room and all of its surrounding agony began to fade into a brilliant white. Dave turned his head on the pillow as his body fell limp into a drug-induced sleep. The reporter on CNN detailed the severity of the Midwest flood. Live video of the disaster featured farmers in rowboats floating around barns. Dave witnessed the destruction from the comfort of his living room couch.
The president is scheduled to tour the area this afternoon, the reporter continued, and it's widely anticipated that the governor will seek federal disaster area assistance.
The devastation didn't faze Dave. It never registered, as he looked past the reporter, past the television set, past the events of the day. His gaze was distant, detached.
I enjoy my art, but honestly, I can paint any time. Watching my kids grow up, being there with them, with you, I'm living my dream.
The picture on the set switched to the weekly forecast, where a young, smiling meteorologist predicted a continued wet year across much of the country.
Climb in bed, Angel, and we'll hide here till Mommy catches us.
The doorbell startled him. How long had he been dreaming? He checked the tabletop for the remote. Not there. He searched in between the cushions. Nothing. Finally, he stepped to the set and pushed the power off. The doorbell rang again. He inched to the door, sucked in a deep breath, and pulled on the knob. On the porch stood six members of his Red Sox baseball team. They shifted their weight uneasily, looking like they weren't sure how to properly stitch together the message they had come to deliver. Kevin, curly-haired and lanky, and the most outgoing on the team, had obviously been designated the spokesperson.
Hey, Coach Riley.
Guys, how are you?
Fine, Coach. We just, we haven't really had a chance to talk. And, well, we wanted to come by and tell you again how sorry we are about the accident.
Kevin's shoulders shifted, perhaps relieved to no longer carry the weight. He continued,
We've missed you at the games and stuff, but that's not why we're here.
Dave inhaled slowly. He couldn't break down in front of the team. Kevin continued,
We didn't know if you'd heard or not, but last Friday we took the region championship.
One of the other boys pulled out a trophy he'd been concealing and handed it to Dave. The base was polished walnut. The silver statue on top depicted a player solidly hitting a ball.
This is for you, the boy added. We play on Saturday for state, Kevin piped up, and we've decided to dedicate the game to Brad. We'll understand if you can't make it, but we wanted to invite you anyway.
Dave bit hard into his tongue, vowing to keep his choking emotions at bay. He forced what he hoped would be considered a smile.
I appreciate it, men. It means a lot. And it would have meant a lot to Brad.
He weighed their invitation before speaking again.
I apologize for not being there for the team the last couple of months. It has been pretty rough. But plan on me for Saturday night. Count me in.
The boys tossed each other affirmative glances, looking happy they'd been able to do some good.
That'd be cool, Coach. We play the Twins from East Windsor, and we think we can take them.
Of course you can. I have faith in you guys.
Great. We'll see you Saturday.
Dave waved, waited, pushed the door closed, leaned back against the wood, and then slid down to the entry tile in a noiseless heap.
Chapter 8. As an only daughter, I learned from my frugal father how to make simple repairs around the house. I can now afford to hire others to do this type of work, but I can't bear the thought of disappointing my father. What this means is that I spent my 2 weeks of vacation painting the outside of my house. I'd been waiting for the painting fairies to take care of the project while I slept. When they didn't show by the second day, I tackled the project on my own. The downside is coming back to the pressures of a project at the university that is behind schedule before it even starts. While most seasoned researchers would begin at the university library, I start this morning at home with my father's roll-top desk. The shelves within the desk and the walls behind it are covered with books about the bridge. Since my father's death, I haven't spent much time in his den. The desk recalls lonely memories, like barbed wire barriers keeping me at bay. Oh, I come in and dust and vacuum and clean the windows. I've even sorted through the drawers and straightened the stacks of papers. What I haven't done is clean out its contents. The desk is old. It was old the day my father acquired it at an estate sale up in the Mission District. But the lock and drawers still work perfectly. Today, my skin chills as I twist the key to release the catch. As the desk swallows its rickety cover, I wonder, like Pandora, if demons wait inside to be released. But once it is opened and exposed, I'm reminded that not all of the memories sheltered inside cause me grief. On the right inside panel, there's a picture I painted in the third grade of a house with a chimney and a white picket fence. I pull it toward me for a closer look. There are smiling faces in three of the windows, and a dog named Oscar in the fourth. There are cows and pigs, and a pasture blended with bushes and trees and small scribbles of yellow flowers in the yard. Next to the house, tall golden and orange spires of a bridge spring forth from the ground. The cable from the bridge connects to the house, becomes a part of it, as if the Golden Gate Bridge is connected to every home. It is a curious picture because there is no water, no deep rugged canyon, no ocean for the orange bridge to span. There is just a house, a family, a pasture with animals, and a bridge. I remember when I presented the picture to my father. He seemed pleased, but then asked, "Katie, where's the ocean?" He meant no harm, but when he asked, I realized for the first time that I'd drawn the picture wrong. I could feel my face flush, which he must have noticed, for he pulled me close and declared it to be the best picture of the bridge he'd ever seen. We left the house and walked together to the drugstore where he purchased a frame. At home, he waited until I was watching and then hung the picture next to the spot where he liked to sit and read. It stayed near him always from then on, and to a little girl, it represented a part of me that had blended with him. And though I had no memories of my mother, or the cancer that took her by my second birthday, it helped me to know that I was still part of a family. Now, many years later, I'm amazed that the desire to belong, felt by a little girl so very long ago, bubbles to the surface with such ease. I know that I must begin my research, so I replace my childhood picture of the bridge and remove several volumes about the Golden Gate from the shelf. Some are picture books, others are histories. As I flip their pages, I wonder what I can contribute that hasn't already been said or drawn or written, can an obscure university researcher make a difference to anyone? I work most of the day and late into the evening. After I've made pages of notes, my eyes begin to burn. It's past midnight, and since I have to be at work early, I return the volumes to their shelves. It's when I look for the key, which I dropped into the main desk drawer, that I notice the corner of a book. Only an inch or so of its spine shows from beneath stacks of old bills. I pull it out and study the cover, but there is no title. It's bound in leather, though it's flaking off in small pieces from the spine to reveal a decaying, powdery fabric beneath. As I open the book, several pages of an old telephone directory that had been placed loose within the cover fall to the desk. I ignore them and turn to the book's inside cover, where I see the handwritten name of Patrick O'Reilly. It is dated 1931. Below the date is an address in Parkside, a few miles from where I live. As I turn the pages, I see notes and hand-drawn pictures. The penmanship is hard to read, but the pages include detailed drawings and cross-sections of the Golden Gate, like it could be a forgotten engineering journal of the bridge. I search the desk and the shelves to see if I have missed other volumes, but all I see besides old bills are more directory pages. Many of the names are crossed off, and I recognize my father's handwriting in the margins. Not home. Try later. Busy. Call back. When I inspect the names closely, I see that every person he called, every name crossed out, every line with a notation by its side, is someone named O'Reilly. My eyes sting, but my heart races. I'm not sure, but I sense that I have just discovered something significant, either for the university or for myself. I know I should go to bed, but instead, I randomly turn the pages. What I see next causes my adrenaline to surge. There is a drawing of a cable, in particular, a cross-section of the 36-inch cables that drape the towers. The picture is penned in ink, and with intricate detail shows how the 3-foot-diameter cables were wound of smaller strands, more than 27,000 in all. The drawings detail how the wire was pulled into one thick cable and then wrapped and banded to hold it intact. There are engineering calculations that note the strength of the cable, how it increases with each added strand. Below the pictures are words I've heard my father repeat often. My father's words, but written in the curious penmanship of a stranger. Together we do the impossible. Like the cable that drapes from her towers, Strauss is joining men together to accomplish greatness. Indeed, we build an impossible bridge. The words ring in my ears. Together we do the impossible. I can hear my father's voice as if he were speaking. I take deep breaths and reflect. It had been difficult for my father to raise his daughter while holding down a full-time job on the bridge. Like most children and parents, we had our moments, times when we each questioned if we'd make it. During those times, my father would often pause, take a similar deep breath, and say, "Sure, it's hard, but honey, together, we do the impossible." He would say it with conviction, as if he believed the words. And because he believed them, I believed them. One time in particular, he even used an actual piece of cable from the bridge. I must have been 11 or 12, already teenage stubborn and making him crazy. After dinner, he set the cable section on the table before me. It was tiny compared to other cables I'd seen on the bridge, but similar in design. It was about 2 inches in circumference, 6 inches long, and made up of many smaller strands twisted together in spiral fashion. When he removed the masking tape that held it together, the twisted pieces fell into a pile of corkscrew pickup sticks. He told me it was a game, and that I needed to fit the curled pieces back together into a single cable. I tried on my own for a few minutes without much success, and then, together, we pieced them into one and secured the tape. He explained that the huge cable draping the bridge was no different. It was simply a bunch of smaller cables wound together to make one giant cable, capable of holding up tons of concrete, miles of steel, and hundreds of cars. He said that people are the same as the cable. We can't make it by ourselves because we aren't strong enough. But if we unite with others, there will be enough common strength. He took my hand and said, "Katie, let's work together. Let's get through this. We'll be like the cable pulling together, doing what we aren't strong enough to do on our own. Believe me, honey, together we can do the impossible."
Chapter 9. Dave arrived 20 minutes late for the meeting already in progress. He straightened his tie on the way to his secretary's desk. "Gloria, sorry I'm late. Do you have the voter crosstab study? Miss Brewer picked it up already. She's with the client." Dave exhaled a lonely breath and headed for the conference room door. He touched the handle, hesitated, and then pushed himself inside. His boss was conducting the meeting. Abel Lawless sat at Ellen's right. Dave acknowledged both. "I apologize. Traffic was heavy." Ellen covered. "No problem. I understand there was an accident in the tunnel. Several other staff members are stuck as well." Dave didn't mention that he'd driven the long way, over the bridge. He knew nothing about the conditions in the Lincoln Tunnel. As the lead in charge of the new account, Dave should have been directing the meeting. He let Ellen continue. "I was just filling Abel in on the results of our focus group," she said. "So, as you see, Abel, the majority of those who vote consistently year after year also attend at least one other annual community activity." The house was a mess. Was it today or tomorrow that the cleaning lady was scheduled to come? Dave tried to remember, but couldn't. He told her to just tidy up the place. Dust, vacuum, light cleaning only. "I want to save the deep cleaning for later." By deep cleaning, she had presumed he meant waxing floors, vacuuming drapes, jobs normally done once a year. But Dave meant something else altogether. Closets needed to be emptied. Clothes needed to be boxed up. Personal items needed to be stored or discarded. "So, what is your assessment of the numbers, Dave?" Ellen repeated. Dave had let his mind drift again. Didn't know how to answer. What to say? He wanted to stand up and shout that it was just another senseless study, that it didn't matter, that tomorrow, not a soul in the accursed room would care about the useless data. "I apologize, Ellen. Abel," he addressed both. "I haven't been feeling well. Could you excuse me?" With a nod, he stood up, hurried to the door, and left the room. Most local ball games were held at the community complex near the town center. The championship game was to be played at Barton Field, just out of Lakewood. It was slated to start at 8 p.m. Dave arrived 10 minutes early. The team would already be on the field, stretching, practicing. "Swing level, Brad. Keep your back elbow up. Be patient. Don't swing at anything out of the zone." He'd wanted to be there for the team, but after the accident, he'd been laid up for days. He still had occasional shoulder pain, but his cuts were healing. He had promised that as soon as he felt better, as soon as he was at 100%, he would be back. When Kevin and the boys from the team stood on his porch earlier in the week, he decided it was time. What better occasion than the championship game? "If the pitch comes in high, Brad, let it go. Attack the ball, connect, and follow through." Cars arrived. People laughed as they carried coolers and blankets into the stadium. Dave stayed anchored behind the wheel. The other coaches had stepped right in and done an excellent job. The boys should be proud. They were the regional champions, after all. Perhaps state champions after tonight. The team had only been together for 3 seasons. Who would have guessed they could pull it together so quickly? Win or lose, they should celebrate tonight.
The shortstop is playing too close, Brad, so if you pop it over his head, you're on base for sure. Keep your elbow up and swing through.
From his car, Dave watched the stadium lights come on. The sun wouldn't set for another half hour, but for the big games, they always turned them on early to give the halogen-filled bulbs time to reach their final temperature and offer the maximum light. At such a beautiful facility, the grass would be cut short and nicely groomed. Dave hoped the hype and the allure of playing on such a large field wouldn't throw off the team's game. Soon, the national anthem was echoing across the arena.
There are 2 outs, Brad, so Kevin will run on anything. Bring him home, son, and watch the fastball. The kid can throw.
The announcer's voice rumbled through the rolled-up windows. Latecomers scurried from hastily parked cars to awaiting bleachers.
Coach, we'd like to dedicate the game to Brad.
The game to Brad. To Brad. Congratulations, guys. You deserve it, Dave muttered aloud. He let his wounded gaze drift away in the direction of the setting sun. And I'm sorry, Brad. He twisted the key, giving the engine life. Without glancing back toward the cheers rising from the stands, Dave exited the luminous stadium lot, turned right on Coast Road, and faded quietly into the welcoming shadows of the night.
A quarter of the way through the pages, amidst many scribbled notes and calculations, I find another bit of wisdom from my father, again written by Patrick O'Reilly. The words are sandwiched among engineering notes detailing the bridge's strength. Interesting facts that I've heard my father recite. The bridge, he said, is designed to hold 4,000 pounds of weight per linear foot, a figure derived by estimating the bridge load when packed bumper to bumper with the heaviest cars made at the time, Cadillacs, Packards, and Buicks. Of course, not everyone drove heavy cars, and there would be space, perhaps 10 to 20 feet, between each as they crossed. And yet, the worst-case scenario was used, and then increased again by a fourth. I can see in the notes where Mr. Patrick O'Reilly summarized calculations for the towers, the trestles, and the piers. In every case, they were over-engineered, designed for the worst that could possibly happen. Below his calculations, he wrote, "In life, always over-engineer." No further explanation. I've heard the lesson from my father as one of his infamous lessons from the bridge. "Quite simply, Katie," he would say, "plan for the very worst, then pray for the very best. Savor the days when the sun shines, but have your raincoat and boots ready for the storms that will always blow in from the bay." His wisdom was sound. In the years since the bridge was completed, calamities have come. Violent storms, devastating earthquakes. And through them all, the bridge has remained strong and true. I can almost hear my father's voice. "Katie, in life, always over-engineer." I wish I had listened more closely.
Habits are born of repetition. They cause ruts in our road that either guide us for good or push us toward peril. Many habits are neither good nor bad, but simply paths worn so deep from repeated actions that our ruts become furrows, and furrows become canyons. Changing course, venturing off in new directions, finding new experience, can be arduous, if not impossible. As Dave studied his unkempt reflection in the mirror, he realized that Megan had been the only one to cut his hair for the last 17 years. He wasn't sure where she had learned. From college roommates, perhaps. No matter. Now that she was gone, Dave didn't know where to go, how much it should cost, or how to explain to a stranger how his hair should be cut. The simple truth was that he hadn't found the courage.
Brock was the first to say something over lunch.
Are you going for the ponytail look?
Something like that. Brock pressed the issue.
Much longer, and I'll have to braid it for you.
When Dave didn't answer, Brock got straight to the point.
Look, I have to tell you. Ellen mentioned it to me the other day. Thought you should know.
Ellen complained about my hair?
Didn't complain, really. Just wondered about it. About how you were doing.
It's none of her damn business.
Hey, take it easy. I don't think she meant anything by it. She's just being the boss. That's all.
My hair is not her concern.
Are you okay?
They'd had the are-you-okay conversation before. Dave had always assured Brock that he would get through it, that he was fine. Today, he couldn't keep up the facade.
I've got to get out of here.
We'll talk later. He snatched his briefcase and stormed out the door. The meeting in Ellen's office started at 7, early enough that Dave hadn't yet arrived. He wasn't invited. Ellen's hands helped her words do the talking.
I don't know what to do for him, Brock. I mean, I'm truly sorry. I can't imagine what he's gone through, what he's still going through. But at the same time, I have a business to run. What am I supposed to do?
Look, things are still rough, but I think he's improving. Brock faked optimism. Ellen didn't buy it.
Improving? You should have seen him with Abel from the governor's office. Dave was in la-la land. When he left the room, Abel was dumbfounded. This was our most important political account, and he's blowing it.
Let me talk to him again.
He needs more than talk, Brock. He needs professional help. I'm telling you, we're losing him.
I said I talked to him. Do you need me to take over the account?
Do you have the time?
I'll make time.
Ellen tipped her head as she considered the offer. She generally didn't take such a personal role with clients, but she'd stepped in to help cover Dave's accounts.
Thanks, Brock. You're my best lead. Just get Dave back. I can't afford to lose him.
Brock couldn't tell if Ellen was more concerned about losing a friend or an employee. Perhaps it didn't matter.
I'll take care of it, he told her. Just give me a few more days.
It was close to midnight when Dave heard pounding on his door. Whoever it was would know he was up. Almost every light in the house was on. Before even touching the knob, he guessed who was standing on the other side.
Hey, Brock, come in. You want a drink?
Brock nodded.
How you doing?
Surviving.
Dave pulled open the fridge door.
Let's see, I've got water, milk, or,
water. Sorry, I guess I need to get to the store.
Actually, I changed my mind. Forget the drink.
Brock pulled out a chair from the kitchen table and sat down. It was clear that he hadn't come to be sociable. Dave grabbed a glass from the cupboard and filled it half full of water from the sink. Not because he was thirsty, but rather to give himself something to hold. No small talk was needed. He didn't wait for Brock. He could already see what was coming.
You want the truth? We're friends. I think we both deserve it.
I can't remember anyone but Megan cutting my hair.
If there was tension in the air, it was shamed silently away by compassion. It felt like minutes before Brock spoke.
Listen, I understand what you're saying. Let me set up an appointment with Sharon. She does mine. I realize it's a scary thought, going to the same woman who cuts my hair, but you'll like her. I may even have her home number.
He reached for his phone.
I can wait. It might be a little late to call tonight. You don't know Sharon, Brock quipped, before perhaps realizing Dave was right. I'll call her tomorrow. Let her know you'll be setting something up.
Okay. Thank you. Even in the weary light, Dave hoped Brock could read his gratitude. He must have, because Brock stood and reached out his hand. The man looked downright pleased at his efforts.
Perfect. Anything else I can do to help?
Brock's tone welcomed back levity into the room. No, I'm good.
Really? I had no idea it was this easy. I should have been a social worker.
It was the first time David smiled since Brock had arrived. I just need some time, he confirmed.
Are you coming in tomorrow?
Brock asked.
I'd better.
If not, Gloria's gonna move her stuff into my office.
Brock shrugged. Women are funny about men showing up.
Why was that?
He didn't let Dave answer before he continued. So, haircut tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow for sure.
Chapter 10. The more I study the journal, the more I learn about Patrick O'Reilly, the man. His writing spanned a period of almost 6 years, from late 1931 to mid-1937, a time frame that corresponds to the bridge's construction. His early pages contain many engineering notes that seem to indicate his responsibilities on the bridge. It is odd, though, when I searched my reference books for the names of engineers who worked on the Golden Gate Bridge, I don't see the name Patrick O'Reilly. A handful of fragmented comments from his journal may explain why. 1931. Hired by McLean, a good gaffer. Odd jobs mostly till she begins. Later, he writes. Trying to keep up me skills, though most days spent welding. The first reference to his possible work as an engineer reads, I met a brilliant chap, Mr. Charles Ellis, and hope to soon be in his employ. The name Ellis sounds familiar. I reference him in a book about the bridge and learn that Mr. Ellis, a senior engineer, is the man many historians credit over Joseph Strauss as the designer of the Golden Gate Bridge. I turn back to the journal and skim it further. The words are difficult to decipher, but as I do, I find another mention of the man. I pray Mr. Ellis will see me skills as adequate. He is the most brilliant engineer I have ever known. It would be an honor to be in his employ. If God grants, I will reunite shortly with Anna and the wee ones again. It will be sooner than planned. I presume that Anna is his wife, and with a name like O'Reilly, I wonder if his family is in Ireland. As I peruse further, I find other notes that indicate his almost revered respect for Mr. Ellis. I met him again today, though he couldn't grant much time. He is working 18 hours a day, but said he could hire me soon. Patience. I see Strauss bow in public, but 'tis Ellis who is the genius. The two are like chalk and cheese. One other mention of a conversation with Ellis grabs my attention. I asked Ellis how he withstood the pressure of working with such brilliant men as Amman and Moiseff. His reply made me consider my own life. He said, O'Reilly, excellence fosters excellence. They force me to be at my best. And the leap of excellence, once made, must be sustained. I look up the names of Amman and Moiseff, and find they also worked as engineers on the bridge. Patrick's words ring true. I've heard them before from my father. Excellence fosters excellence, Katie, he would say. For this reason, he didn't object to my never-ending education. You're surrounding yourself with good people. Growing, learning, loving. Why not? Perhaps it was the fact that my father hadn't attended college himself. Perhaps he could read my trepidation of taking on the world. Either way, he never complained. My curiosity about Ellis gets the better of my patience, and I turn back to several history volumes. I learned that he served as the chief design engineer under Joseph Strauss, but that the relationship between the two men seemed doomed from the start. While Ellis, a reserved academic, focused his energies on his work, on the soundness of the bridge design, Strauss, his boss, was overly concerned with getting credit. Most historians agree that although Ellis was unquestionably the more brilliant, Strauss was the one in charge. I shouldn't have been shocked then, to find out that after Charles Ellis had worked tirelessly to deliver completed engineering calculations and a structural bridge design, and even before a shovelful of dirt had been turned, Joseph Strauss fired him. I wonder how Patrick O'Reilly reacted to the firing of the man he so admired, a man with whom he had hoped to work. I note the date of the firing, a few days before Christmas, 1931, amidst a deep national economic depression. In Patrick's journal, I find no mention of the event, only a single, poetic notation. My hopes are thrown into the blustery bay wind. Vanity is victorious over virtue. 'Twill be longer than I had expected as Anna and the young ones mire in misery. I scan the journal thoroughly, but find no further reference to Mr. Ellis.
7 silver hoops outlined the right ear of the female cashier chatting with Brock from behind the counter. Her nose and eyebrows hadn't been forgotten either, all heavily pierced as well. He was killing time while Sharon finished with her current customer. According to the clock on the wall, Dave was 6 minutes late. Brock excused himself to check his phone. No reply to the text messages he'd sent to Dave. "Hi, handsome," Sharon purred as she approached. "Hey, beautiful, you look astonishing," Brock replied. Sharon laughed as she brushed away the strands of black hair still sticking to her white blouse. "Am I doing you today?" she questioned, not having checked her schedule. "I wish," he replied. "But my buddy needs a cut worse than I do. And you have to be gentle with him."
"Is it the guy who lost his wife?"
"Same one, and I mean it. Go easy on him."
"Not a problem. Where is he?"
"He'll be here." Brock dialed Dave again. Voicemail picked up. "Hope he's not too late," she added.
"I'm booked solid today, and I hate making customers wait."
"Don't worry," Brock assured. "He'll be here, I promise. Any second he'll be here." Dave sat alone in his office. Brock didn't knock. "Hi, bud. I missed you this morning." Dave's eyebrows rose. His eyes widened. He glanced at his watch.
"Oh, that's right. The haircut. I'm sorry. I forgot."
Dave's phone was sitting on the desk. Brock tapped it with his finger, hard enough to make a noticeable thud. "And you didn't hear your phone ringing? I only called 30 gazillion times." When Brock wasn't buying, Dave's surprise turned into a shrug. He no longer cared.
"Sorry, I couldn't make it. I had some things come up."
Brock pulled a chair up to the desk. He turned it around and straddled it backwards, resting his arms on the back. "Dave, I'm going to get in trouble for what I'm about to say."
"About what?"
"Look, I'm just apologizing in advance. But if I'm going to be a true friend and not just a drinking buddy, then there are some things that need to be said." It was a side of Brock that Dave had seldom seen, and he felt his teeth clench in response. He looked first at the door, then back to Brock.
"Say it, then," Dave demanded, his tone turning defensive.
"Meg, Brad, Brittany, and Angel, they're gone, Dave, and they aren't coming back. It's been weeks, even months, and you're not getting better. Truth is, you look like hell. You need to get some help."
"You have no idea what I've been through."
"That's true, and I pray that I never do. But if I ever have to go through anything even half as bad, then I hope you'll be as good a friend to me." Dave didn't answer, and Brock wasn't ready to stop. "Look, I'm not saying that you need to paste a smile on your face all the time. I'm not saying you need to party every night. What I am saying is that it's time to face the situation. If you can't do it on your own, then let's find someone who can help." Dave wanted to run, to storm out of the office. Instead, he sat like a statue, motionless and cold. After seconds had passed, his troubled eyes peered up.
"Reality sucks," he said.
"Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Sometimes it does, Brock answered. But even so, there are times I envy you.
Envy me? I've lost everything.
Don't be stupid. I'm not saying that I envy what you've been through. Nobody would suggest that. I'm talking about what you had before the accident. Your wife. Your children. I mean, look at me. I know I act as if life is Disneyland all the time, but the truth is that I've never had anyone close in my life. Nobody who truly cared for me. Maybe never will. You want me to feel sorry for you, then? Is that what this is about? No. I just want you to realize that while you're feeling pretty lousy right now, life is a whole lot better than you're making it out to be. It was evident that in Brock's own way, he was trying to help. Look, Brock, I'm sorry I missed the appointment. I'll do better. Brock hesitated, seeming to weigh whether he should keep going. As long as we're having this heart-to-heart, I'll tell it to you straight. Your work is suffering. Ellen doesn't know what to do with you. Is she going to fire me? No, not yet, anyway. Just take a deep breath and get on with it, man. You still have a hell of a life ahead of you. And hey, get a haircut. You're scaring me.
Chapter 11. I eat my lunch every day in the park next to the history building because the grassy lawn and walkways there are always filled with students and teachers. It's the perfect spot to study strangers. People watching is a curious habit, like being a spectator in a human zoo. As strangers pass today, I wonder about fate. I wonder about the ways lives intersect. I wonder about the part that fate plays. For example, take those walking past. They don't see me. They don't even realize I exist. So, what if Mr. Wright walks past, and just as he steps in front of me, I sneeze, and he turns and notices me and says hello, and we talk, and then get together. And so, from one simple sneeze, two strangers' lives change forever. If this is how life works, then I'm terrified, because what happens if he walks by and I don't sneeze? Besides worrying about sneezes, I often make up games. Today, I'm guessing people's careers. The older man with graying hair pulled back into a ponytail is no doubt an artist, a painter of modern art, to be more specific. The woman wearing too much makeup walking close behind, eyeing him, she works for a cosmetic surgeon. The man with the briefcase and the tie? Well, he must be a CEO of a multinational conglomerate that makes, let's see, tongue depressors. Other days I'll match faces to celebrities playing a separated-at-birth game. It's amazing how many people do look like the rich and famous. Just 2 days ago, for example, I swear that Paul Walker walked past. It wasn't him, of course, since he's dead, but it was still exciting. No matter the game, I'm always curious about other people's lives. If I see a man or a woman sitting on a bench alone, and if I have a chance to study him or her closely, I often begin to interrogate the person in my mind. Are you married? Do you have children? Do you also stay up late to watch old black and white movies? Do you sometimes eat cold pizza for breakfast? Have you also been betrayed by someone you love? What makes you laugh or cry? And most important, through it all, do you still hold dreams in your heart? I also wonder about people when I visit the bridge, when I stand at the railing and peer over the side at the water, when I see the darkness of the waves rolling 220 feet below the deck. At these times, I also question how the lives of strangers intersect. What about the people my father saved? Are they now mothers and fathers? Do they have honest jobs, and are they trying to raise their children to have a better life? Are they still on drugs, or depressed, or angry? Are they even still alive? Or did they find some other way to accomplish their dreadful deed? Mostly, I wonder if they've ever realized the goodness of the man who saved them. Do they understand that they ultimately took away the only person who ever mattered in my life. I wonder if it was destiny that my father was there to save them. And if it was, then what about the man who pulled my father off the bridge? Did God play a part in that as well? I wonder if the whole thing could have been stopped. I wonder if the man who killed my father could have been distracted even for a second. Would the outcome have been different? I wonder what would have happened if, at just the right moment, my father had sneezed.
It was dark when Dave entered the building. It was better that way. He preferred working on his projects at night, when it was easier to think, when there were no distractions. Remnants of a cleaning crew clanked distant garbage cans, though he could see no one. They were like mice, working by night, vanishing by the light of day. An older Hispanic woman cleaned the floor where Dave worked. He had run into her on occasion when he'd stayed late. One night she'd been humming, but stopped when Dave entered his office. She'd seemed apprehensive, even frightened. He tried to ease her discomfort by chatting, but it proved difficult. She wouldn't look him in the eye. She fidgeted incessantly, and she always nodded in the affirmative, no matter what question was asked. Now he could empathize. It was so exhausting to function, to concentrate, in an office full of people who are whispering about the guy who lost his wife and children. Dave looked over his desk at the deepening piles of work. It was always the same. He would vow to improve, promise to hit the job and life with a new attitude first thing in the morning. But as with most silent pacts, promise proved easier than performance. Tonight was no exception. After 20 minutes of tossing paper clips into the garbage can across the room, Dave stretched through the guilt and stood. He was self-destructing, and he knew it. He just didn't know how to stop. He wanted to stay, to make an effort. But the walls were closing in, and his breathing was becoming labored. He grabbed his coat and headed toward the exit. He would come in early tomorrow instead to finish his reports. As he waited for the elevator to slide open, he noticed light peeking out from under the door of Brock's office. He walked toward it. "Hello?" He tapped lightly and then pushed the door open. There was no sound. No one inside. The light must have been left on by accident, or perhaps the cleaning woman wasn't finished. He checked the garbage. Empty. She'd already made her rounds. Brock had been a good friend. Better than Dave might have been had the tables been turned. Dave would never have had the guts to say what Brock had said, wrong or not. As Dave reached for the light switch, he noticed a stack of mail on the chair. It was the letter on top that caught his eye. He picked it off the pile and studied it. Standard business size, starched white color. What captivated Dave was the graphic on the envelope's corner, the brazen orange and black outline of a customized Harley-Davidson road bike. In the protection of both silence and solitude, Dave let his finger trace the outline of the machine. What dreams are you missing out on? You won't laugh? I probably will, but tell me anyway. I've always wanted to buy a motorcycle and ride across the country. A motorcycle? Like a Harley? When he turned the letter over to check the postmark, he noticed that the envelope had already been sliced open. He listened again for any sounds from the office. The stillness confirmed he was alone. He pulled the folded paper from its sleeve, spread it flat, and began to read. It was addressed to Ellen, but had been copied to Brock. "Dear Miss Brewer, it was a pleasure speaking with you last week. As I mentioned, I've heard wonderful things about your firm. It turns out you're actually not far from our location in York. As the nation's largest customizer of Harley-Davidson, Indian, BMW, Ducati, and other major motorcycle brands, I'd like to hear how your research can improve the impact of our ongoing national expansion. While it's true that we take good products and make them remarkable, We'd like to better understand the demographics and purchasing habits of our clients. It's not enough to create the most sought-after customized bikes in the marketplace. We need to maximize our advertising budgets by increasing our customer understanding.